Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on design of living things when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell was one of the pillars of modern geology, and he published his Principles of Geology back in 1831. It's Lyell's concepts that are so widely accepted today that most people who believe in these concepts don't even know that it was Charlie Lyell that created them. But it was from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised. And he did that by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood could be strictly ruled out. And then they called that process science. Well, listen to this. When we talk about erosion, what's even more surprising is the discovery that all of the continents on planet Earth would be worn down to sea level in just 14 million years. If we just extrapolated into the future from today, the erosion processes that we observe today, the world would be worn down as smooth as a billiard ball in 14 million years, but there's no evidence for such drastic erosion. The mountains and valleys on planet Earth today appear to have been made very recently. They are sharp, they are angular, and their appearance testifies to their youthfulness. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? They told us 65 million years ago. But boys and girls, if you went back 14 million years with the same erosion processes that you observe today, today the world should be as smooth as a billiard ball, and it isn't. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudoscientific laws. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the guise of science. And this is just one more of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School that we conduct twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri, here at the law school. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. And maybe this isn't for you. Maybe it is. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free. Doesn't cost anything to get started. And you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Then just flip over, you know, with a click of a mouse to our email address and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Design of living things. You know, we take a look at something that's alive out here, and we go to school, and the teacher tells us, well, he doesn't tell us, he just reads it out of the book. The book tells us that millions and billions of years ago, this or that happened, and then this or that happened, and you see, life spontaneously generated out of dead rock. The life that you see around you today, everything, all started from dead inorganic matter. Well, that's what they tell us. And furthermore, it started just by happenstance. No design involved. No designer involved. No intelligence involved. Just the shake of the dice. I call it the miracle of random chance. The miracle of random chance caused it all. Now, when anthropologists dig in the earth and they find a triangular piece of sharp flint, they conclude that it must have been designed by someone to be the tip of an arrow. Now, such things designed for a purpose, scientists agree, could not be the products of chance. But when it comes to living things, the same logic is totally abandoned. A designer is not considered necessary to create a woodpecker or a giraffe. But the simplest single-celled organism, or just the DNA of its genetic code, is far more complex than a shaped piece of flint. And yet evolutionists insist that these had no designer, but they were shaped by a series of chance events, the miracle of random chance. Now, Darwin recognized the need for some designing force, and he gave natural selection the job. Natural selection, he said, is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the world the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, preserving and adding up all those that are good. Now, that view, however, is now beginning to lose favor. Stephen Gould reports that many contemporary evolutionists now say that substantial change may not be subject to natural selection, and it may spread through populations at random. Gordon Taylor agrees. He said that natural selection explains a small part of what occurs. The bulk remains unexplained. Geologist David Ropp says a currently important alternative to natural selection has to do with the effects of pure chance. But is pure chance a designer? Is pure chance capable of producing the complexities that are inherent in the fabric of life? Zoologist Richard Lewontin said that organisms appear to have been carefully and artfully designed. He views them as the chief evidence of a supreme designer, and it will be useful to consider some of this evidence. Let's take a look at some little things. So let's start with the smallest of living things. They're single-celled organisms. A biologist once said that single-celled animals can catch food, digest it, and then get rid of the wastes. They can move around, build houses, engage in sexual activity, and with no tissues, no organs, no hearts, and no brains, really have everything that we've got. And diatoms, one-celled organisms like silicon and oxygen, or they take silicon and oxygen from seawater and they make glass, with which they construct tiny pillboxes to contain their green chlorophyll. They're extolled by one scientist for their importance and their beauty. These green leaves, enclosed in jewel boxes, are pastures for 9/10 of the food of everything that lives in the sea. A large part of their food value is in the oil that diatoms make, which also helps them to bob buoyantly near the surface where their chlorophyll can bask in sunlight. Their beautiful glass box coverings, this same scientist tells us, comes in a bewildering variety of shapes, circles, squares, shields, triangles, ovals, rectangles, always exquisitely ornamented with geometric etchings. These are filigreed in pure glass with such fine skill that a human hair would have to be sliced lengthwise into 400 slices to fit between the marks, which can only be seen by an electron microscope. Now, one group of ocean-dwelling animals called radiolarians make glass, and with it they build glass sunbursts with long, thin, transparent spikelets radiating from a central crystal sphere. or glass struts are built into hexagons and used to make simple geodesic domes. Of a certain microscopic builder, it is said, one geodesic dome will not do for this super architect. It has to be three lace-like fretted glass domes, one inside of another. Now, words fail to describe these marvels of design. It takes pictures to do this. Sponges are made up of millions of cells, but only a few different kinds of cells. A college textbook explains, the cells are not organized into tissues or organs, and yet there is a form of recognition among all of the cells that holds them together and organizes them. If a sponge is mashed through a cloth and separated into its millions of cells, those cells will all come together and rebuild the sponge. Sponges construct skeletons of glass that are very beautiful. One of the most amazing is called the Venus Flower Basket. Of it, one scientist says, when you look at a complex sponge skeleton, such as that made of silica, silica spikes and spicules, which is known as the Venus Flower Basket, the imagination is baffled. How could quasi-independent microscopic cells collaborate to secrete a million glassy splinters and construct such an intricate and beautiful lattice? We don't know. But one thing we do know, chance is not the likely designer. Now, here on page 144 are a number of pictures that are taken from an electron microscope of these single-celled little animals, and they have etched on the glass casing, like an insect is encased in his skeleton. These diatoms are encased in glass. And on the glass are etched etchings. And these etchings are beautiful designs. Now, why in the world would this little diatom evolve by making this glass case around itself? One cell creates this glass case around itself, and on the outside of the glass case are all of these little etchings. And the etchings on all of the different types of diatoms are all different. Now, why would they evolve that way? By random chance. If all of them had evolved, and they all had the same etching, we could say that one came from the other, but they all have different etchings on them. Now, what's that all about? You know, when we take a look at a Chevrolet automobile and we compare it to a Ford and then a Cadillac and then an Oldsmobile and then a Volkswagen and then a Peterbilt truck, they do have certain similarities. You know, they've all got two headlights. They've all got one radiator. They've all got a hood. They've all got a steering wheel. So we take a look at that and we say, well, you know, one must have evolved from the other because of these similarities, don't we? I mean, don't you presume that a Peterbilt truck evolves out of a Volkswagen? You know, simple to the complex. You know, if I came up to you and I said, how do you like my new Peterbilt truck? You'd say, wow, that's pretty good. Where'd you buy it? I said, I didn't buy it. I found it out in my field. It evolved. It just put itself together out of inorganic rock. You know, I think you'd say, you know, Gordon, we need to lock you up. Now, we take a look at a cow out in the field and we say, well, that cow just evolved over a long period of time out of inorganic rock. Just happens to be there. That somehow seems to be scientific. If I said to you, my Peterbilt truck just evolved, put itself together. You know, an automobile, they tell us, has about 14,000 parts to it. I was out putting a battery charger on my pickup yesterday. I ran the battery down, so I put the battery charger on there. And as I looked inside there, I noticed that there was this engine. This engine has an air cleaner sitting on the top of it. Have you ever seen an air cleaner on the bottom? Have you ever seen the pan on the top? You know, if you take a look, all of these engines are pretty similar. The air cleaners are always up on the top. You ever notice that? And the pan is always down on the bottom. Peterbilt trucks are built that way. And so is Volkswagens. And, you know, so do we say, well, my gosh, obviously one evolved from the other? Or do we say, well, they all have a designer? And the designers of these automobiles follow a certain pattern. They put two headlights on them. Why not six? How come we don't have 16 headlights? How come we don't have lights on the doors? I mean, if these things evolved, wouldn't we expect, if a horse evolved, wouldn't we expect to find some intermediate horses with 3, 5, or 9 eyes? Why two? Why do all animals have 2 eyes? How come we don't find some animals with 3, 5, or 9, or 1? Well, there should be some intermediate species, you know, between whatever preceded the horse and the horse today that had different amounts of eyes. How come we all have 1 liver? How come we don't have 2, 5, or 9 livers? I mean, you know, a liver is a pretty important organ. Seems like to me that we could use 2 or 3 of those. In case one of them conks out, we got another one. Got 2 eyes. If one of them gets gouged out, we still have 1 more eye. But, you know, if your liver goes, hey, why are you just dying? Now, there's a thing called symbiotic relationships. Now, in many cases exist where two organisms appear designed to live together. These partnerships are examples of symbiosis, that is, living together. Certain figs and wasps need each other in order to reproduce. Termites eat wood, but they have to have protozoa in their bodies to digest it. And similarly, cattle, goats, and camels could not digest the cellulose in grass without the help of bacteria and protozoa living inside of them. And a report says the part of a cow's stomach where that digestion takes place has a volume of 100 quarts. It contains 10 billion microorganisms in each drop. 10 billion microorganisms in each drop. Algae and fungi team up and become lichens. Only then can they grow on bare rock to start turning rock into soil. Stinging ants live in hollow thorns of acacia trees. They keep leaf-eating insects off the tree, and they cut up and kill vines that try to climb on the tree. In return, the tree secretes a sugary fluid that the ants eat, and it also produces small false fruit which serves as food for the ants. Now, did the ant first protect the tree and then the tree rewarded the ant with the fruit? Or did the tree make the fruit for the ant and then the ant then thanked the tree by protecting it? Or did it all just happen by chance? Just random chance? Or was it designed and intended to work that way? Well, those are the questions, and in many cases of such cooperation exist between insects and flowers. Insects pollinate flowers, and in return, the flowers feed the insects pollen and nectar. Some flowers produce 2 kinds of pollen. One fertilizes the seeds, the other is sterile but feeds the insect visitors. Many flowers have special markings and smells to guide insects to the nectar. En route, the insects pollinate the flower. Some flowers have triggered mechanisms. When insects touch the trigger, they get swatted by the pollen-containing anthers. For example, the Dutchman's pipe cannot pollinate itself, but it needs insects to bring in pollen from another flower. The plant has a tubular leaf that envelops its flower, and this leaf is coated with wax. Insects, attracted by the smell of the flower, land on the leaf and plunge down the slippery slide into a chamber at the bottom. There, ripe stigmas receive the pollen that the insects brought in, and pollination takes place. But for 3 more days, the insects are trapped there by hairs and the waxed sides. Then after that, the flower's own pollen ripens and dusts the insects. Only then do the hairs wilt and the waxed slide bends over until it's level. The insects then walk out, and with their new supply of pollen, they fly to another Dutchman's pipe to pollinate that one. The insects do not mind their 3-day visit, since they feast on nectar stored there for them. Now, did all of this happen by chance? or did it happen by an intelligent design? Some types of Opries, orchids, have on their petals a picture of a female wasp complete with eyes, antenna, and wings. And it even gives off the odor of a female in mating condition. So the male comes to mate, but only pollinates the flower. Another orchid, the bucket orchid, has a fermented nectar that makes the bee drunk on his feet. He slips into a bucket of liquid, and the only way out is to wriggle under a rod that dusts the bee with pollen. Now, is this designed to work this way, or did this all happen by accident? Now, if you're sitting there saying, oh, it just all happened by accident, you know, hell, you'd buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There's reason, there's logic, there's common sense. And then there's things, you know, when you contemplate them, you take a look at. I'm not sitting here telling you have to believe in Jesus and Him crucified. I'm just telling you that something out there is smarter than that bee and that flower. The bee had to be there to pollinate the flower, or the flower would become extinct. Now, there's a process that that religious guys believe in. It's called the gap theory. And they believe that evolution is the means that God has used to create the world. And that's because the religionists are pretty ignorant people. I've said before, you know, that the religious, the preachers, not religious people per se, but the preachers, you know, the guys that are the Holy Joes, the Sky Pilot, they are among the most ignorant that God ever put breath into. They're the worst enemies of the Bible. They cannot explain Genesis 1, 2, and 3. They don't believe Genesis 1, 2, and 3. That's the first problem over here. Preachers believe that the Bible is a lie written by a bunch of dumb Jews that didn't know which end was up. Truth of the matter is, much of the Bible was written by people who were not Jews. That's number one. Moses was not a Jew. He was a Levite. Came from a different family. He wrote 5 books. Paul said plainly that he was from Benjamin. He wasn't a Jew. He followed Jewish religion, no doubt about that. But he was a Benjaminite. So the moral to the story is over here, the religious guys, they believe that the 7 days of creation were really 7,000 years. Which makes absolutely no scientific sense at all. Because you see, as you read through Genesis chapter 1, God starts off and He says, in the evening and the morning were the first day, and here's what I did. And in the evening and the morning were the second day, and here's what I did. And the evening and the morning were the third day, and here's what I did. Well, on one of these days, He invented flowers. Well, when He invented the flowers, those flowers, if they had to live 1,000 years before the next day when He invented the insects and the pollinators, then all of those flowers would have died during that 1,000 years and became extinct. And then when He got to making the bees and the insects on the fifth day, then they would have all died because there wasn't anything to eat. There's nothing scientific about the gap theory. It's an attempt by religious guys to answer evolution with the Bible with stupidity. It's not even ignorance. It's stupid. It doesn't make theological sense because it denies the description given in the Scripture. It doesn't make scientific sense because it's unscientific. At least do one or the other, you know. Now, there are some guys come along and say, well, I think that God created the world just exactly like He said He did. Now, that's pretty hard for all of us to swallow because, you know, it's a big place. It's got a lot of different things in it. And you and I can't do any of that. And since we can't do it, we're sitting around here saying to ourselves, well, because we can't do it, well, I don't believe anybody else can. And this God guy over here, I don't think he could have done it either. which is like saying, well, I don't think that a 747 will fly because I can't build a 747. I don't think anybody else can, and therefore they don't exist. Now, you know, if you were talking to somebody, you know, let's bring up General Lee and General Grant back in, you know, they died back in the 1800s. Let's bring them to life today in 2007. Take them out to Kennedy Airport and let them watch operations out there from the tower, you know, for a half an hour. What do you think those guys would say today? And they'd think that was miraculous. That it was, you know, they'd just blow them away, wouldn't they? If you'd have taken the 747 and flown it at about 300 feet over the Gettysburg battlefield, what do you think all them soldiers out there would have said, looking up and watching that thing fly across there? Why, if they would have caught the crew, they would have burned them at the stake for being witches or something. They couldn't grasp science. Now, there is real science out here. And the Bible is just full of real science. The Bible is full of spectroscopic analysis, meteorology, the atomic theory, the round earth. Now let's take a look at an example of science here. I'm going to demonstrate a little piece of science. When I was a kid, I went to public school, just like the rest of you. I went to public school, and I remember the tallest mountain in the world, because in 1953, there was a guy named Sir Edmund Hillary, and he climbed to the top of Mount Everest. And he did it in 1953, which was the same year that Queen Elizabeth was coronated queen. It was a big, big deal. I was the biggest deal for the whole year of 1953. And two of the biggest deals in the history of the world occurred in the same year. A queen was coronated. That doesn't happen every day. You know, if you're like me, you've only seen one coronation in your lifetime. Queen Elizabeth. It's the only one I can remember. I mean, there might have been some king down in some little African country that was coronated, but he didn't make any splash in any newspaper that I read. And then this guy, Edmund Hillary, he climbs to the top of Mount Everest. Now, I'll tell you that what was so spectacular about that was that Mount Everest, the tallest mountain in the world, was 29,002 feet. That's 29,002 feet. Now, in case you didn't know this, this is before satellites. This is before, you know, they had OnStar. And even back in the olden days, you know, back in the olden days before OnStar, they could measure the height of a mountain. So when you look at old books, if you could pick up an old Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, dated back in 1953, it would say Mount Everest was 29,002 feet. Now, the other day I happened to be looking at a new encyclopedia, and Mount Everest is 29,035 feet. And I noticed that. That's 29,035. Now, that's a difference of 33 feet. Now, from 1953 to today, you know, it's roughly, let's go 1950 to 2007. In about 50 years or so, Mount Everest has grown 33 feet in 50 years. 33 feet in 50 years. I figured 57 years for my calculations. I just went back to 1950 and 2007. Now, there's 12 inches in a foot, and this is evolution at its best. I mean, if you want to, you know, if you're going to talk about evolution, Mount Everest is evolving. The crustal plates are moving. And this is a part of geology. And this is a part of the evolutionary story. I mean, here's evolution working today. Hell, I can put on a better case for evolution than the damn evolutionists can. Surely a lot better case than the theologians can. Mount Everest has grown by 33 feet. I don't doubt this at all, because today we've got OnStar, and Mount Everest is 33 feet taller today than it was 57 years ago. That's amazing. So I said, wow, let's do the arithmetic. So I took Mount Everest at 29,035 feet times 12 inches. And then I divided that by the 33 feet that I divided into 57 years. And it comes out to about 7 inches a year. So Mount Everest is growing at 7 inches a year. So I said, wow, here's evolution at its finest. So I went back to Charlie Lyell. Remember Charles Lyell? He was the guy that discovered uniformitarian geology. And I applied uniformitarianism to Mount Everest. How old do you think Mount Everest is? If Mount Everest started out at sea level, growing 7 inches a year, how many years would it take to reach 29,035 feet? How many millions of years would it take for Mount Everest to start at sea level and grow to 29,035 feet? Well, just in case you're a plumber, a carpenter, or electrician, and you're suffering from the terminal stupids, you know, and we can't figure this out, only evolutionists can do this. Only scientists can do this. I mean, some guy putting pipes together couldn't do this in a thousand years. Well, I tried, and I got my Sharp EL1197G3 out, and I punched in these numbers. Now, here's what you do. You take 57 years, 1950 to 2007. And it grew 35 feet. So you take the 35 feet times 12 and divide that by 57, and I think you're going to come out with about 7 inches a year. It was 6.9, so I rounded it off to 7 inches a year. Now, let's take Mount Everest today at 29,035 feet times 12 inches in a foot divided by 7 inches per year, and you come out to, get your pen out here, boys and girls, here's science at its best. 49,774 years for Mount Everest to grow from sea level to 29,035 feet. Far less than the billions and billions of years that we're told that it takes for this to do that. And then, in the top 300 feet on top of Mount Everest, you know what's up there? Clams, mussels, all kinds of seashells. Boys and girls, less than 50,000 years ago, Mount Everest was underwater. The top of Mount Everest was underwater less than 50,000 years ago. Now, there's no reason to believe that it took 49,000 years for Mount Everest to grow to that height, that elevation. It's still growing. But the Bible reveals that there was a worldwide catastrophe called Noah's Flood, in which there was a period of mountain building. And when you take a look at the Andes and the Himalayas, those are sharp, angular peaks. In 14 million years, Mount Everest, with today's erosion rates, should be down to sea level. Hell, it ain't going down to sea level. It's still growing by 7 inches a year. How do you like that? Yeah, I got to give you a reminder here, children, and that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors and publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, or they may be religious or economic or sectarian or racial, or they could be ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. And this report that I'm making to you, it comes from a book called Life, How Did It Get Here? By Evolution or by Creation, put out by the Watchtower Bible Tract. They call themselves the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania. International Bible Students Association, all rights reserved. Copyright 1985. 18,800,000 copies. This is more than just a bestseller. I mean, if they made 18 million copies and gave every one of them away free of charge, which I don't know if they charge for this or not. I would imagine they probably give them away or sell them at cost or something like that. So if you'd like to get a copy of this book, you could probably get one from your used bookstore. I mean, there's 18 million copies out there. There's more copies of this book out there in circulation than there are most other bestsellers that you've read, like Lady Chatterley's Lover or Harlequin. Harlequin doesn't sell 18,800,000 copies. So you could try that. And if you don't find it there, well, then I highly recommend it. This is one of the better evolution books that I've seen. Now, somebody's going to say, oh, that guy Gordon must be a Jehovah's Witness. That's why I just told you. I said, you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything that Jehovah's Witnesses put out, but this is one thing I do agree with. These guys have spent some time, effort, and energy, and they've got some real good footnotes in here. I mean, they've got the names, the dates, the times, the places, the facts, the witnesses, and the evidence. This is science. And science at its best. Put out by the Watchtower Society of Pennsylvania. 18 million copies are in circulation, written on a level that all of us can understand. I think that most scientists write their books and they use these big words in here so that they can bedazzle us with how smart they are. The thing that I liked about this book and really recommend it is that it's written in simple, easy to understand language, without all of the big scientific terms that you and I don't understand anyway, and it don't mean jack diddly squat to us, but it's written in language that you and I can understand, pick right up on. Hell, if you got a kid that's 10 years old, I think he can pick right up on that. Now, there's words in here like water molecules hold together by cohesion. I mean, that's about the most scientific phrase in the whole book. You know, maybe you need to look up the word cohesion. Maybe you need to look up the word molecule. I don't know. I happen to know what cohesion and molecules are, so I didn't need a dictionary for that. But I've read books that I had to sit down with a dictionary, for crying out loud, in order to read the damn book. That's tedious, to say the least. This is not a tedious book. And I'm not recommending Jehovah's Witness theology. And at the end of the book, they've got some theology. They're trying to sell you their religion. And I don't deny that. They're trying to sell you their religion. And hey, their religion's as good as any and better than most. I mean, I wouldn't put it down. I wouldn't advance it. I don't subscribe to it. I don't buy into it. But, you know, if you do, more power to you. No problem with me with that. What I got out of this book was that these people took the time to put the science together with the theories of evolution and come up with a cohesive whole. And boy, and this chapter here does it in spades. Does it in spades. And it's called Partnerships. It's the amazing design of living things. Now, there's a fig tree. There's different kinds of fig trees, but there's one kind of fig tree that can only be pollinated by a special wasp. If this wasp, not just any wasp, there's lots of different kinds of wasps. This is a fig pollinator wasp. And the story behind this fig tree and this wasp will just bedazzle you. This little wasp has a lifespan that is related to the life cycle of the tree. It isn't related to any other life cycles of any other wasps. And this wasp, he goes into the fig and dies in there. But he lays his eggs, and his eggs, or this female does, and her eggs hatch into larvae, which then hatch out, you know, develop into wasps, and then that wasp, he bores his way out and flies over to another fig, bores his way into it and dies. And then the dead wasp in there doesn't do jack diddly squat, but he lays his eggs in there and they hatch, and that's the way this tree is fertilized. It's from the offspring of the wasp at a later time. There isn't any way in hell that happened by chance. Now, I don't know if Allah did that, or Buddha did that, or Elohim did that, or Yahshua, or Jesus, or God, or, you know, you can hang whatever label you want on him, but I'm telling you that, you know, when I walk out here and I look at a Peterbilt truck, I say, wow, that's a pretty neat piece of machinery there. That's well designed, well engineered, well constructed, well put together. That thing was put together with intelligence. It was put together by design. It was put together on purpose. There's a reason behind it, and it works. Well, that fig tree and that wasp has intelligence behind it. It works. In fact, that fig tree out in the jungles out there feeds I don't know how many different kinds of animals. Those figs are the life of many kinds of animals that live off of those figs. So it's not just the fig tree and the wasp. Without that fig tree, other whole species of animals would die because they live off those figs. And if they didn't have them, well, then they wouldn't have food. Now, that's part of the story that's laid out here in this book that I just described to you, Life, How Did It Get Here by Evolution or by Creation. Now, let's go on and take a look at another. We've got Nature's Factories. Green leaves of plants feed the world. Directly or indirectly, they feed us all. Green leaves. But they can't function without the help of roots. Millions of little roots. And each root tip is fitted with a protective cap. And each cap is lubricated with oil. That way they can push their way through the soil. These root hairs behind the oily cap absorb water and minerals, which travel up minute channels in the sapwood to the leaves. In the leaves, sugars and amino acids are made, and these nutrients are sent throughout the tree and into the roots. Certain features of the circulatory system of these trees and plants are so amazing that many scientists regard them as almost miraculous. First, how is the water pumped 300 feet into the air above the roots of a redwood tree? Well, root pressure starts it on its way. But in the trunk, another mechanism takes over. Water molecules hold together by a process called cohesion. It's because of this cohesion, as water evaporates from the leaves, up in the top of the tree, water is evaporating from the leaves. The tiny columns of water are then pulled up like ropes reaching from the roots to the leaves 300 feet in the air and traveling up to 200 feet per hour. 200 feet an hour. This system, it is said, could lift water in a tree about 2 miles high. If a tree were, in fact, 10,000 feet high, it would work. As excess water evaporates from the leaves, this is called transpiration. Billions of tons of water are recycled into the air, once again to fall as rain. Now, this is a perfectly designed system. Now, if you live out here in the Midwest like I do, let me tell you a little story over here, because this is a part of this design process. I look outside my office window, and I see a great big oak tree out there, full-grown oak tree. It's probably, 3 feet anyway, maybe even 4 foot in diameter. I mean, if you cut that tree down, it would be 3 feet, maybe 4 feet. I cut one big oak tree down here at ground level. It was 8 feet across. From one side to the other side is 8 feet. Now, that's a big oak. Hell, that's as big as a redwood tree, for crying out loud. Now, oak trees get to be pretty big. They don't get to be 300 feet high. They get to be about 100 feet high, maybe. And so they taper, you know, they start out down here at the ground level in the root system, you know, they're pretty big if you get a big old oak tree. Well, anyway, this big old oak tree out here, scientists have been out here measuring it, you know, and they come up and they say, take your taxpayer dollars, here's your taxpayer money at work. They work for a university. And they don't do anything constructive. They don't produce food, clothing, and shelter. What they do is they just watch oak trees. And they measure the transpiration, how much water do the leaves give off, and then they write books, and then that's where we get all this information. Which, you know, when it comes to feeding, clothing, and housing, this doesn't mean jack diddly squat, but, you know, if you're interested in this kind of thing, you couldn't write a book on evolution. You couldn't see the miracles that are all around us without these scientists who spend their time measuring and weighing and writing books about these kinds of things. Well, this big oak tree that's out here outside my office window gives off 1,800 gallons of water a year. And all of the water that it takes in comes in through its roots. And so it rains down here on the ground. And the water soaks into the ground, and the roots pick up the water in the ground, and then it goes up the sapwood and then out to the leaves, and it gives it off. Well, the water that's given off goes out into the atmosphere. That's 1,800 gallons a year, times millions of those trees all over the Ozarks. Now, this is not quite rainforest here. It rains about 50 inches a year here. 60 inches they call rainforest. Now, it used to be a rainforest here until we started cutting down the trees. Now, here's a little miracle for you. Down in the Amazon basin, it used to rain in 1957, 120 inches a year. Today, it rains 90. So they've lost 30 inches a year. And it just so happens that they're cutting down 4,000 square miles of forest every year. Now, you start out in 1957 until the year 2007, over 50 years, and you cut down 4,000 square miles to do that. That's 4,000 times 50 years. It's 200,000 square miles. Or it's a piece of real estate about the size of two Montanas, or about the size of Montana and Idaho combined over the past 50 years. That's how much they've cut down in the Amazon basin. And the rainfall down there has correspondingly decreased from 120 inches a year down to 90 inches a year. Now, here in the United States, we've been cutting down trees just as fast as we can. And here in the Ozarks, I don't know what the rainfall was in 1880, but in 1880, the Ozarks was covered by forests. From 1880 until 1940, we cut down all the trees so that we could build railroads. And we did. And we built all these railroads, and we cut all these trees down. Now, our rainfall is dependent upon these trees. It is true that the sun does shine on the ocean, and it evaporates water. About 1/7 of the amount of water that's in the atmosphere that rains down upon us every day comes from the ocean. The other 6/7 comes from the trees, grasses, and other vegetation. Now, boys and girls, that's pretty impressive. That's pretty important. Now, my neighbors around me, they don't know the story about how trees and transpiration puts all of this water into the atmosphere, because here in where I live, it rains year round. We don't irrigate here. It just rains every month. It rains here. Now, out in California, you know, you Californians know that it doesn't rain out there except in the rainy season from about September through April. In May, June, July, and August, and it doesn't rain there. Now, you might have a thunderstorm come through and drop 5 drops on you, but for practical purposes, it doesn't rain there. Here, it rains. In the summertime, it's not uncommon to have 2 inches of rain come out of a thunderstorm. Where does that water come from in July? It comes from the trees. That's where it comes from. It comes from the trees. And it's the circulation. The circulation from those trees. Now, when we cut those trees down, we cause drought. Now, you go over to the Sahara Desert, that used to be grasslands back in Roman times. They went out there and they cut down all the trees. They farmed it and let all the dust, you know, the dirt blow away, just like we did during the Dust Bowl era here in the Midwestern United States in the High Plains. Desertification is beginning to set in Iowa now. There's evidence that desertification is beginning there. If we continue on here for another 1,000 years in the United States of America, we will turn this continent into a desert, we humans. It's been our history in the past. We turned the Gobi into desert. We turned the Sahara into desert. And by the way, the Sahara is expanding by 100 square miles a year. And in China, the Gobi Desert is growing by about 100 square miles a year also. And then down in Brazil, we're working as hard as we can. I mean, we're cutting 4,000 square miles of trees as fast as we can every year so that we can decrease the rainfall. Well, if we keep it up, you know, at some point in time, we'll turn that Amazon basin into a desert also. You know, just give us a little time here. Now, the reason I bring this up is because the systems that we see, the meteorological systems, the trees and the animals and the chlorophyll and the processes that we see, is carefully designed and created by a mastermind. I mean, this guy's smart. Real, real smart. And the whole earth is in balance until we come along and screw it up. It's in balance until, you know, you and I come along here like my neighbors. They bring in bulldozers and they bulldoze down all the trees so they can plant grass. Which makes all the sense in the world when you're in the cattle business. Cows don't eat trees, they eat grass. So we burn up all the trees and then we plant grass. Okay, now, as we do that, we have fewer and fewer trees. Now, every time you cut down one of these big trees, you eliminate 1,800 gallons of rain. Well, you know, 1,800 gallons of rain isn't the biggest thing in the world, but, you know, it's a bunch. It's a bunch. Now, I'm running some water right now into a pond at the rate of 1 gallon a minute. Now, if you take 1 gallon per minute, times 60 minutes in an hour, times 24 hours in a day, that's about 1,500 gallons of water a day, on round numbers, 1,500 gallons. That's less water every day at a gallon a minute. That's less water than that tree produces in a year. Puts 1,500 gallons of water into my pond, but, you know, that tree will evaporate that much water in the course of a year, put it up in the air, which rains back down on the ground in a never-ending cycle, which then the surplus water runs off into the creek, which then runs off into the river, which then runs off into the ocean, which then jumps back onto the... See where we're going with this? So here in the Midwest, we depend upon these trees. Now, I'm sure that down in tropical areas, most of your rain comes from the oceans. But when you get away from the oceans and you get inland, then most of your rain doesn't come from the ocean. It comes from your trees, and it's just recycled water. And this whole meteorological process was well thought out. I mean, it just doesn't happen that way. This thing had to be planned out. It had to be thought out. And it works, and it works perfectly until, you know, we get in here and we start screwing the thing up. Irrigation is one of those things. Pumping all the water out of the Ocala aquifer over here isn't one of our smarter moves. Taking all the water out of the Colorado River isn't, you know, the most intelligent thing we ever came up with. There's limits, you know, to how much you can do. Now, a little irrigation is probably a good thing. Poking a hole in the ground and pumping water out of the ground is probably a good thing. But, you know, when you carry it to extremes, it upsets the design in the machine. In the same way that you get a Peterbilt truck and they send you an owner's manual with it, and they tell you this is the kind of oil to put in it, here's the kind of fuel to burn it, here's the kind of grease to grease it with, here's the kind of fluid you put in the windshield washers. And if you follow the owner's manual, that truck will give you a lot of good service for a lot of years. But, you know, if you start mixing and matching, you know, if you want to try putting windshield washer fluid into the crankcase of the engine and engine oil into the windshield washers, you're not going to be able to see out the windows near as well, and the engine isn't going to run near as long. Now, there's something about human beings that we just have to push the envelope. We have to push the limits. And that's what we've been doing. And then we come along and we say, well, now we believe that we're evolved and that we evolved from inorganic rock, because the alternative to that is unthinkable. Yeah, you can say that again. Because we were told to dress and keep the garden. And you know, we're not dressing and keeping the garden by cutting down 4,000 square miles of forest and depreciating the rainfall by 30 inches over 50 years. I don't call that dressing and keeping the garden. Now, by the same token, God gave us these trees to cut down to build our houses. But did it ever occur to us that if we're going to cut down 4,000 square miles, that maybe we ought to plant 4,000 square miles? Don't you think we ought to go out here and replant some of those trees and then call those tree farms? You know, if we're going to bulldoze down a patch of ground over here and plant grass, don't you think we ought to take some other piece of ground and plant trees on it so that we can maintain our atmospheric meteorology, so that we can maintain the rainfall, so that we can maintain our lives, and so that we can, you know, avoid these droughts and one thing or another? Just a wild new observation on my part, that maybe if there's a designer, maybe that designer has some rules, maybe that designer had a plan in mind that if we would follow that plan, we'd get better service out of the earth that we're all living on. Spaceship Earth, this has been called. We're all on it, and we all depend upon it for our livelihoods and for our lives. Don't you think maybe we ought to take a little better care of it? That's the creationist view. Hey, we're about out of time again, so let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website. And the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.